Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to Whoa! Potluck.
And welcome back to another episode of Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Ye.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here to discuss our October 2019 book club pick, Summer of the Big Bocce by Naomi Hirahara. So yeah, Rira, yesterday was Halloween. How was your All Hallows Eve?
I worked. I did crafts with little children, and they were all germy. So I had to take a lot of vitamins and a lot of like precautionary medication after I was done. And I dressed up as Pikachu. My coworkers also dressed up as Nintendo characters. So there was a theme going on. Yeah, Halloween is my favorite holiday because it's, you know, when I was younger, it was just kind of like, oh, it's kind of like an anime convention, but like you get to dress up as whatever you want.
So. Everyone's cosplaying.
Yeah, this was before I was able to go to an anime convention. So
nice. So
Halloween was the only time I could dress up. So I was very, very excited.
That's awesome. I did nothing. I stayed at home and actually did some work.
You know what? That sounds way better than my Halloween so far.
Yeah, but now it's November, so the unofficial start of the illegal Christmas season has started. But it also means Thanksgiving's coming up. Which,
man, I've been seeing Christmas stuff since August, so I'm like so over Christmas. Christmas is my least favorite holiday. It's at the very bottom of holidays.
I don't mind Christmas. I do prefer Thanksgiving, but that's just because food.
And I also don't like Thanksgiving.
Well, I actually do have a story, though, about the Christmas creep. I was at the Irvine Spectrum the other day, and they already have their giant Christmas tree up. Mm-hmm. But next to the Christmas trees, they have signs apologizing for having it up so early. They basically wrote this big kind of an essay explaining how logistically it makes more sense to put it up now as opposed to later so that it's up and ready in time for Christmas. So really, I guess it's a logistical thing, but still.
I guess so.
But yeah. Are you ready for the Christmas movie season?
No. Unless they're Christmas slashers, then I'm all in.
You're not a Hallmark type person.
No, I really, really hate it. it's really funny because I have friends who have interned or worked for Hallmark.
Uh-huh.
And one of them is like really into it. And then the other is like, I need to leave. I need to get out. So I think there's only like two categories for people who are like in relation to Hallmark and Lifetime movies.
Yeah. I don't mind a good sappy rom-com. I don't seek them out. But I do appreciate that Hallmark has been working on diversifying their lineup in the recent years, which is great. But our October book club pick isn't a Christmas story.
No, and it never will be. But yes, we read a mystery novel, and it's been a while since we read a mystery novel.
Yeah.
I think, I don't know, like our past book club picks kind of like blur together for me. It's like, did we read this a year ago or did we read this a couple months ago?
It's really hard. It's been a while since our last like detective story. The last one we read was IQ.
Yeah.
By Joe Ide. And that was,
I think that was January, right? That, or December.
Yeah, I think that was like earlier this year or late last year.
Yeah.
Zero Sum Game was kind of mystery, but I don't categorize it as mystery.
Yeah, that's
per
more
se.
Like a spy thriller.
Yeah, I don't know. Genres are, they don't mean anything in the end. It just helps us, you know, talk about tropes and whatnot. Anyway, we're going to start with the summary of the book.
Before, though, our standard spoiler warning.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. We are going to be talking all about the plot and the twists of Summer of the Big Bocce by Naomi Hirahara. Like we mentioned, it is a detective mystery book. So if you don't want the whole thing spoiled for you, you should go read the book first. Seriously, this time. For all of you who actually read books after we talk about them, you should probably read the book first so you don't spoil yourself of the joy of reading a detective novel.
Yeah, like this is one of those books where you should jump into it as cold as possible.
Yeah.
Right.
Much like the movie Parasite, which we can't.
Oh my God.
We cannot talk about
that movie. Was so good. My mom talks exactly like
the rich mom.
Yeah. What was it? The Kims, right?
Yeah. So, no, the Kims were the family infiltrating the Parks. Okay. It's the Parks.
The Parks. Yeah. Yeah. That she talks exactly like Mrs. Parks, and it was just so funny to me. And like, as someone who like grew up around a lot of tutors, it was like very reminiscent of like my parents being like, we have to find the best like specialist or whatever. And it was just like, it was so funny. Yeah.
But
anyway.
Yeah, we're here to talk about Summer of the Big Bocce. Support our Patreon for.
We keep saying that. Like, when is that going to happen? I don't know. Hopefully at the end of this year, we'll figure something out. Yeah, because we tend to, like, have a lot of overlapping interests, like video games and movies. So that is something that we should consider for special episodes, I guess.
I'm just glad to have more people to talk about Parasite with. If our listeners want to talk about Parasite, let's just start a thread on our forums.
On our forums.
But yeah.
Okay, so we're going to get right into the summary. In the foothills of Pasadena, Mas Arai is just another Japanese-American gardener, his lawnmower blades clean and sharp, his truck carefully tuned. But while Mas keeps lawns neatly trimmed, his own life has gone to seed. His wife is dead, and his livelihood is falling into the hands of the men he once hired by the day. For Mas, a life of sin is catching up to him, and now Bocce, the spirit of retribution, is knocking on his door. It begins when a stranger comes around asking questions about a nurseryman who once lived in Hiroshima, a man known as Joji Haneda. But by the end of summer, Joji will be dead, and Mas's own life will be in danger. For a while, Mas was building a life on the edge of the American dream. He has kept powerful secrets about three friends long ago, about two lives intertwined, and about what really happened when the bomb fell on Hiroshima in August 1945.
Yeah. So right off the bat, this is our third detective novel for this book club, and also our third detective novel about a detective that's not really
a detective.
He's more because,
so it's not really right to say it's a detective novel, more right. Like...
we're the investigator.
Investigator?
Is not a cop.
Yeah. Like, noir... subculture. I honestly don't have like a correct genre description for books like these. But it is really, really nice that this book is so local.
Yeah.
And as people who live in the same town and the same area as this book is set in, it
was really interesting to, because the story is set in the late 90s, right?
Yeah.
And yeah, during that time, I was growing up in the city of San Gabriel, in the San Gabriel Valley, just like literally maybe 10 miles south of where Mas lives in the story.
Yeah. And the town and the area has changed a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because in the book, you read about like, I don't know, was it like South Pass or Altadena? Like,
yeah.
He was just saying like, oh, it's like the... not so great parts of this area. And I'm like, oh, wow, it's gentrified so much. And like what used to have a lot of like small ethnic communities, I feel like they've kind of been pushed out as, you know, as the usual with gentrification. So it was interesting to see like how that has changed.
Yeah, and definitely there was and there still are a lot of Japanese nurseries in the area and in LA in general, but a lot of them have been either replaced or
downgraded.
Yeah,
right. I actually did not know that Pasadena used to have like a really big Japanese American like community,
mm-hmm.
because you know like when I moved there,
yeah,
I was just like, oh, this is the town where like the young hip people are, like the young Caltech students are.
And I wouldn't even say Pasadena in general, because Mas lived in Altadena, which is kind of like
it's a little bit north of Pasadena.
Yeah, it's the suburbs of the suburb of Pasadena. And Pasadena was where his clients were, which made sense.
Yeah, which made sense. There are parts in Pasadena where like
those lawns are huge.
You see like apartment buildings, and then if you go a little bit like a little bit south,
yeah,
like there are these huge country homes with ginormous lawns, and they're always green no matter the drought situation in California, which is like a really big deal.
It's a very affluent suburb in Southern California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But how did you feel about like Moss being like this old cranky gardener?
I liked it. I think in this current time of like YA themed stories taking over popular culture, it's kind of cool to see a story centered on like a non-young, beautiful person. Right?
Yeah, yeah. Because even like detective shows, investigative shows, like they have like young, sexy people. And
yeah.
or like, you know, like middle age, like, you know.
Hard-boiled
detectives. And it's nice to see someone who's not a detective.
Yeah.
To see someone who is kind of like really reluctant to like investigate.
Yeah. Like, Moss is a very interesting character because he's American-born. Like, he's a Kibe, right? Which mm-hmm. is a term that they use, which is American-born Japanese. But he's also not fully Japanese, not fully American in terms of culture, because he lived in both, right? And, I mean, that is illustrated through his language, like the way that Naomi Hirahara writes how Moss talks to people.
Yeah, the dialect and stuff. Actually, before this discussion, I went on her website and there's like a page where she talks about like her Masarai series, because this is a series. There's like six books on.
I think there's nine.
Nine?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, nine books on Masarai as like the main character.
It's Marvin. A little correction here. Naomi Hirahara actually has written seven Masarai books, not nine. Sorry about that.
And Naomi, she writes that Moss is actually inspired by her father, who was a Japanese-American gardener who talks like Moss and who was also a Hiroshima survivor. So a lot of those characteristics are in Moss as the protagonist.
Right.
But of course, as like novel writing goes, like things are going to deviate. And I heard that like Naomi's father is actually like a very happy, like a happy jokester. And that doesn't really work with the story.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that Moss was like a cranky gardener, because I really like the Miss Marple series by Agatha Christie. And that is also like a series where it's like an old woman who like is very nosy and just kind of gets like dragged into investigations. She's a little bit more proactive than Moss, but I'm really down for like old people just like taking advantage of their age to like get into like crime investigation scenes, and you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. The type of person that no one would really notice because he's a gardener. He has a Ford with tools. I really enjoyed that he wasn't your typical PI investigator, but he is a really good investigator. He's super observative. He notices like things that other people miss, like details. I guess because he's been a gardener for so long and he's able to use that expertise to help him with his investigations.
I think actually his skills as a gambler helped him more with investigation, because like he knows when people are bluffing or like he like when he comes up with plans to get more information, like he doesn't know if it's going to work out. He's like, okay, well, like, this is a gamble, and these are my odds. And, yeah, like, I really like that aspect as well of about like gambling addictions, because I heard that that was like a common thing amongst like older Asian American gens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I wonder, I mean, it's an issue amongst Asian people in general. I don't know as a sample if it's any more or less than any other population, but definitely it's like one of the few problems that families talk about in Asian families is if you have someone who's addicted to gambling.
Yeah.
I mean, some part of it, I guess, is the characters in the book, at least most of them, are working class to like lower middle class people whose, you know, upward mobility has been, you know, hampered either by society, by fate, or, you know, by their own gambling addiction. And a running theme throughout the book is kind of the American dream, right? And how the pursuit of it leads people to do certain things.
So there's a lot of characters in this book.
There's and a ton of them. We were going through all the characters before we started recording. And yeah,
there's a ton. But I do want to talk about I guess like the presentation of this book, because it is a mystery novel, but the mystery doesn't kick in until well, not the mystery part, but I guess like the murder part doesn't
right.
happen
the crime.
Until like
the crime.
The crime doesn't happen until like the middle of the book. And I guess like the first act, there are like hints of like, okay, what is going on? Like there are people looking for people who are from the past, and you know, you're trying to piece together Moss's relationship with these characters that that like the antagonists are looking for.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like reflecting on it now, this story takes place like a week before a traditional detective story would take place, right? Which is the crime, a week before the crime.
Mm-hmm.
Because even before the crime happens, which is basically the murder of a woman, there are people poking around Moss's past and bringing up people that he hasn't thought about in years. And that starts unraveling until it leads to a crime happening.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to look at the front page. So in a traditional noir novel, or even just like a crime show, the cold open is always like the crime or
your Law and Order, like chung chung
dun dun. But like if Summer of Big Bocce was formatted that way, the first chapter, the cold open, would have been the bombing of Hiroshima.
Mm.
And seeing the bodies and seeing like the shock factor, and then it would cut to Moss being older and right. in a different country. And sorry, I went to school for screenwriting. So like for me, it's like, okay, like that's the traditional way to tell this story. But I kind of like put into consideration of like when this book was published. This book was published in 2004. And the setting is, you know, 1999. And I'm thinking about like how many like writers, crime writers of color, like in like just like the literary world. And there weren't that many, even for like the 2000s. So I wonder if Naomi, she knew that and she kind of like hatched a plan beforehand and was like, okay, well, you know, I need to woo the readers to make Moss like, I don't know, like attractive to the readers, like make them be invested in him as a character, and then bring on the mystery and kind of reel them in. I don't know if that was her initial strategy, but that's kind of what I thought when I was reading the book.
I mean, they do plant the seeds of the mystery because the prologue is the death of Joji Haneda, quote unquote, and the setting up of like the big bocce, right?
Yeah.
So the reader already gets a sense that like there is a mystery here.
The opening scene, or I guess like the first two chapters, it's about Moss going to this gardener's meeting, like an annual, I don't know if it's annual, but it's like a gardener's meeting where mm-hmm. they like talk about collecting money for their funds.
Right.
And
like
whatnot.
The credit union.
Yeah, the credit union. And you meet Nakane, who is the main big bad of this book, and he's asking questions about Joji Haneda, and
right.
that's your first clue as to like, okay, Moss has a secret past. if you did not read the jacket summary like I did, I tend to do this way more often than I should. I should really, you know, read the jacket description before reading things.
I mean, you don't have to. I don't think it's a must since you're already reading the book.
Yeah.
Like, we're already reading it. We don't need to be sold. Right.
That's true. But I should read it just for like content warnings, because that has happened in past book club picks where I'm like, oh, right. If I had read the jacket description, I would know that like this kind of thing would happen.
But, yeah.
But anyway, like that is your first hint that something is going on. And yeah. I guess like the larger mystery aspects don't show up until like maybe the second act, and the yeah. first act is mostly dedicated to like Moss's family and how he is a survivor. Like, he survived Hiroshima and he outlived his wife,
yeah,
and how his daughter Mari, like how he has become estranged from her, and just like his relationship with other Hiroshima survivors,
yeah,
and how each of them cope differently. So a lot of it is like sketching out the characters before you get into the mystery aspect. And that's really crucial, because a lot of the mystery has to do with like Joji and Ricky's like false identity and their relationship. So how are you going to like set up a mystery if you don't know, yeah, who these people are?
And also how it connects to like his survivor's guilt and everyone's survivor's guilt. And the first act of the book sets him up as someone who just wants to live his life and move on. He doesn't want to get involved with anybody. He's like, what's the generation above the boomers? Or would he be a boomer?
He would be a boomer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not really, because he's not like in that culture. But yeah, all that sets up his character as someone who he just wants to like take it day by day, do what he's used to. Like, he doesn't like change. Doesn't like to be inconvenienced. He doesn't want to inconvenience other people. He just wants to go through his life and, like, you know.
I liked how there were different types of Japanese Americans and Japanese folks. like with Moss, we were saying earlier, he's an American-born Japanese who was born in California, but he left and moved to Hiroshima and was raised there for most of his life. And he grew up during the war when Japan and America were enemies.
Yeah.
And you also have Joji Haneda, who is American-born Japanese as well, but he grew up in America much longer,
yeah,
and moved to Hiroshima.
The real Joji Haneda.
Yeah. Yeah, the real one, not Ricky Kimura. And then you have Wishbone Tanaka, who is the head of the Gardner Credit Union.
Tanaka's gardener shop.
Yeah, Tanaka's, yeah, gardener shop. And he was a no-no boy.
Yeah.
And you also have Tug, who actually served in the American
442nd.
Yeah.
I really liked how there was this parallel on both the Higabusha, which are the atomic bomb survivors, and the survivors of the Japanese incarceration internment,
yeah,
camps, right? And how no one got out of that time period unscathed by war, either through surviving a atomic bombing or surviving like the literal incarceration, taking away your rights. And how even within both these groups, there are different factions or different viewpoints and different, just different groups, right? Like,
I think a lot of, there were like a lot of definitions of like patriotism. Mm-hmm. It's like, what does it mean to be an American? Like, does that mean like serving in the military and like pretty much fighting against like your
yeah,
parents' brotherhood or whatever.
I think it's more so. Naomi Hirohara doesn't really dwell on this. She kind of gives a brief overview of the tension between Nono boys and the Gopher Book, 442nd, mm-hmm, the people who served, right? But the general tension is, I don't think it's fighting against your parents' homeland. It's, do you prove your patriotism or do you prove your Americanness by serving for the military and fighting for their cause, or do you prove your Americanness by like resisting the unlawful like removal of your rights and your property and your family?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think the fighting the motherland is really the crux there.
Yeah.
It's the, why should I serve you when you don't even see me as a person?
Yeah. And then you see the reverse of that, because like, you know, Joji and Moss, they are American citizens, and you have Ricky, who is, you know, full-blooded Japanese, born and raised. And he's like, oh, you guys are like traitors and you guys are from, you guys are pretty much like enemies to us. And that's not just Ricky. That's like pretty much everyone in Hiroshima, and how like Joji and his sister Akemi, they had to like burn like American goods in their homes to not like to prove themselves to be loyal to Japan.
The tension on that side is similar, because you have Mas, who was 15 but couldn't enlist in the Japanese Navy because of his American status and because he wasn't a dual citizen.
Because he wasn't registered in the Japanese registry.
And he wanted to serve to prove his Japanese-ness, whereas Joji is someone who, like, the real Joji, is someone who spent a lot of his childhood in America, spoke Japanese with, like, an American accent, right? Mm-hmm. And was much more, like, American in his cultural identity.
Also, he believed that America was going to win.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Ricky was portrayed as like a bully. He's kind of like, you think of your Japanese delinquent, right?
Yeah.
But from what I remember, he also coveted the fact that both Mas and Joji had papers and could leave to go to America. And it was something that like Ricky also saw the fact that they were American as something that he wanted.
Yeah. I mean, like America has always been a symbol of opportunity, right? And with Ricky, like it seemed like all of them were in the countryside. This is before Hiroshima has modernized and, you know, has got their, you know, boom in their economy. So like for Ricky, it's just like, I'm stuck here. Mm-hmm. Like I have to like the only path for me is to like work in the farmlands. And like, I'm not going to make any money off of that.
Yeah.
And then like once the bomb drops, like the only way he can make money, because now he's an orphan, he has to like deal in the black market. I mean, he turns out to be really good at it, but that is like his only way to make a living.
Yeah.
So like to him, like an American citizenship, like having papers is, I guess like it is a symbol of freedom. It's a symbol of opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like he was already a grifter even before the bomb dropped.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, like he was, like you said, he was like a Japanese delinquent.
Yeah.
Like the kind you see in movies and stuff. But shall we move into the actual mystery part, because we have talked about half of the characters so far.
I mean, I feel like if I was to write this screenplay, the opening scene would be Yuki coming across the crime scene, right, and getting arrested.
I guess, yeah, that would work too.
In like a traditional like Law and Order style, like procedural or something, right?
Yeah.
Like that's the crime. So a third through the book, this woman, Junko, who is the mistress of
Ricky, who is posing as Joji,
Haneda, gets attacked. And Yuki Kimura, I guess the young reporter investigating Joji Haneda, is pretty much arrested for the attack, right? Because he's on the scene, he has blood on his hands, and this spurs Mas reluctantly into action because you kind of get the feeling throughout the entire book that he is just so inconvenienced by everything that's happening.
Yeah.
Like he's just annoyed at everything that's happening to him. But he gets brought in because to unravel like this mystery that has something to do with him so personally, and B, because he kind of sent the boy to the crime scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Bocchi right there.
I mean, should we talk about the concept of Bocchi in general? Because I feel like that's
that is like
central to this story. It's also part of the literally the title.
From the jacket description that I read earlier, like it describes Bocchi to be the spirit of retribution. And it's also tied in with Kokoro, which is, I guess, like your
inside.
Your like moral state of being. Like, I don't know how to like translate it because I'm not Japanese. So I mean,
I think the closest analog is your conscience and your soul, pretty much. Right.
Yeah.
And Naomi Hirahara does delineate the difference between like Bocchi and karma, which is like, this is what goes around comes around, but in this life. It's not something you pay for in your next life, as in the Buddhist notion of karma. It's something that like you will pay for in this lifetime because of something you did.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really interesting that the titular Big Bocce doesn't become apparent until like two-thirds, almost to the end of the book, right? Which is closely related to the fate of the original Joji Haneda and what happened on the day of the Hiroshima bombing.
Yeah. Right? Actually, like, I was really confused while I was reading the book. I was like, okay, there's like the title is Big Bocce. So mm-hmm. I'm just like, okay, like, what is the Big Bocce? Like, we come across like small ones, right?
Yeah, small
like,
bocce's here.
Like, Moss gambling when his wife suddenly gets ill from like miscarriage, which mm-hmm. is towards like the beginning of the book, and him being like him not participating in Mari's school project, which is something that I'll go back to.
Yeah.
And him not revealing Ricky's like true identity, like him being an imposter.
Him losing his Ford.
Him losing his Ford. And then
him
like,
sending Yuki to get arrested.
Him yeah. stealing money from Ricky in order to pay for his passage to America.
Right. Which results in him losing his dream nursery.
So like while yeah. I was reading this book, I was like, is the Big Bocce just like a series of bocce that just kind of like culminate like accumulated? And but then you kind of get to the end and you find out that like I guess like the original bocce that kind of sets everything else in motion is that after the bomb hit Hiroshima, Moss finds an injured, I guess to be more exact, like a dying Joji.
Right.
And he promises Joji that he will find his sister to make sure that she's okay. And he runs off, but he blacks out. And it's not until, like, he doesn't wake up until much, much later. And it's already, like, too late for him to find Akemi. And he kind of assumes that Akemi is dead. So,
yeah.
like, that is the Big Bocce. That is the ultimate bocce.
Yeah, that the fact that he abandoned his friend.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, the past that gets unraveled is the fact that him, Ricky Kimura, and Joe Tineda were all like really close friends in high school. And that they worked together at the train station, right? And that was mm-hmm. where they were when the bomb fell. And I remember there was a line in one of the chapters, I think it was when Yuki Kimura, the reporter, comes and like reveals his identity to him. He's already off center because of Ricky / Joji coming back into his life through this kind of sleazy Japanese man, Shuji Nakane, looking for him. And he says, is this just one final Big Bocce from Joji Haneda? And at that point in the book, you don't know that Ricky is the true identity of Joji. And I thought that was really clever.
That was really clever. I actually figured it out pretty early on that Joji mm-hmm. Haneda was not really mm-hmm. Joji, because you don't have someone like come in asking about someone who is still alive, but like they're investigating a crime. I'm just like, okay, like stolen identity. I mean, it's like an immigrant story. Like it was like with Paper Sons, it was much, much easier to like to create an identity to go into America. So I just kind of assumed that was that was the twist. And I'm not belittling that, because you know, if it's a twist that I can predict, that means that it was well structured enough, well set up enough for it to land.
I mean, if you want to dig into the conspiracy that sets up the crime, which sets up the mystery, right? It all comes back to, as these types of stories go, it comes down to money, right? It all goes back to someone's going to make a lot of money off of this thing, and they need to find this other thing to make that happen. And when that doesn't work out, they kill someone. So like the underlying, I guess, MacGuffin is the land that the Haneda family owns in Hiroshima is basically still under the family name. It's under Akemi's name. Akemi is the sister of Joji Haneda, the original Joji Haneda. who was Mats Arai's neighbor in Hiroshima.
Because, like, in Japan, like, Joji is listed as among the dead.
Yeah.
So, like, when the, like, who do you, like, what would you call Nakane? Like,
he's, like, the enforcer.
Land enforcer?
Yeah,
land,
he's, like.
Land shark? I don't know.
Like, much like how, you know, like, organized crime people have enforcers to do their dirty work for them, rich developers also have probably people who do their dirty work for them, right? Like contractors or investigators, right? And so this land is worth a lot of money because there's a developer that wants to pretty much buy it and build something bigger.
Yeah.
Right? Like a big development. And
this is after the war, obviously. And this is when Japan is like really speeding up industrialization.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so lo and behold, they're negotiating with Akemi and also her grandson, Yuki, who is... I mean, you find out that he initially made a deal and he backed out. And that's when they start putting the pressure on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, fake Joji Haneda / Riki Kimura does a TV special about his nursery. And everyone starts putting two and two together.
Was it about his nursery? I thought it was about like him being a Hiroshima survivor.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that sounds right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds like something he would do. That's why I'm like, oh, that's probably what it was.
And so that leads both the investigators, Shuji Nakane and
Yuki
to go to the States to find out if this guy is furry or not.
Yeah.
And so
I actually really liked because when Yuki meets Moss at the hospital. He shows him like a drawing that a witness did of Joji's dead body.
Mm-hmm.
And like, and that's your first hint of like, oh, Riki is not Joji because Joji is found dead in Japan.
Yeah.
And
well, no, you don't know that it's Joji yet.
Oh, yeah.
They think it's the body of Riki Kimura because he was found with the Riki Kimura's name tag.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Right.
But I really liked that setup though, because at the end of the book, you find out that the clue was there the entire time because of the name tag and because like they listed their blood type.
Yeah.
Like you find out that like, the circle that, the real Joji Haneda had drawn on the ground, that was like.
His clue.
That was his clue.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really, really well put together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, something that only Mats Arai would notice and figure out.
Yeah.
Right.
And that pretty much unravels like everything from like it foils Nakane's plan because now the land can't go to Kimura's like children, like the children that he had in America posing as Joji
Haneda, like they aren't the legitimate heirs to this piece of land.
Yeah.
And like this isn't your traditional detective story where it starts with the crime and ends with it solving it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's part of the story, but the story moves on because like you mentioned before, this book is also a character study of survivors of the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And for Mats Arai, like his reason for solving the mystery is A, to make up for the bocce, for getting Yuki in trouble in the first place, but also to make up for the big bocce, which is to fulfill his, you know, his, I guess, moral obligation to
atonement.
His dead friend.
Yeah.
Because through this whole ordeal, he gets reconnected to people that he knew, memories that he had suppressed, and also people that he thought were long dead, right? Yuki Kimura is the grandson of Akemi Haneda, who is Joji's sister, who even shows up in the book.
Yeah, right? Yeah. And, you know, he's literally being visited by someone who he thinks is dead and someone he was supposed to take care of after the bombing.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was really clever because... she uses the last name Kimura.
Mm-hmm.
So he's like, whoa, like, so Yuki is the Yuki is the grandson of Riki Kimura, and they don't know that they're related. But it turns out that they're not related
at
all.
That was a great misdirection.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really got me.
I thought it got me too. And I liked how Moss was just like, there's no way that she would have slept with Riki Kimura. And I'm just like, you don't know. Like something could have happened, but like he ended up being right. Like she never slept with him.
She just Rose Dawson did, right?
Yeah.
But throwing out that 90s Titanic reference.
But Bocchi kind of comes up with other characters as well. Like Rumi, who was the escort / hostess, she lies to the police saying that she witnessed Yuki being the killer in Junko's apartment, when it turns out like she actually saw the real killers, which were like they said it was some white dude who was hired by
I
don't know.
I forget his name.
Daniel Hawthorne.
Something Hawthorne.
So, I don't know.
Random white guy who's just a henchman, which is great. Great casting in this book.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, she is attempting to run away because she's just like, I don't want to be deported to Japan. Mm-hmm. Like, whatever. And after being almost killed in like a car accident, she's like, oh no, like,
it's the Bocchi.
It's the Bocchi. Like you said that my soul won't be like the same. So I went back to like make the atonement, and it was nice to see Rumi actually go back and like set things straight, because you see Moss and you see how the Bocchi has affected him over the course of 50 years. So you see someone who is able to make things right away. And then like with you see like the Bocchi with like Wishbone Tanaka, because you know he didn't get the money.
That reveal was I didn't expect that,
like that he set up everything, that he set up the meeting between Nakane and Moss,
that he was involved in the
in the
crime.
I do want to talk about Mari, Moss's daughter, because she shows up a lot in this book for some character who is not
in the
actually
book
there. I heard that she kind of makes an appearance in the third book.
I mean, they set it up because at the end of the book, Akemi leaves a note that Mari has been calling Moss. Mm-hmm. And so he leaves a message saying, "Is Dad call me?" And I think that's the inciting event for the second book to jump off of.
All right. Yeah. Right. What I liked about this book, I said this earlier, that it kind of like paints, I guess, like a portrait of like the Japanese American community.
The diversity of it.
The diversity of it. And you see Mari and you see Joy, who are Nisei. Second generation Japanese American, and I really liked.
Well, Mari is a Nisei.
Joy is
a Sansei.
Sansei, yeah. I really like the contrast, because you see Moss, who wants to forget about the atomic bomb, and you have Mari, who wants to know more about it. She's writing. She's doing a school project on it, and I thought that was a really powerful scene, because like she just wants an A in her class, and she thinks it's like really important, and that, you know, that part of history should not be forgotten. But for Moss, it's like, I want to forget it.
Yeah.
And why does the younger generation want to like keep painful memories alive? It's better to be left alone. And because Moss is unable to talk about his own experience, Mari has to interview Haruo, and Haruo actually has like physical damage on his face. Like he doesn't have like his right eye.
Yeah.
And he has like a scar on like his head. And he's the one who has to tell Mari about that day.
Yeah.
And
I really liked Haruo. He was just like, He's just happy to be there.
He's the reason why, like, Moss had to, like, get involved in so many things. It's just like, oh, like, my friend with his gambling addiction, he's sick. I have to, like, take care of him.
And right.
It's, like, a good incentive for him to, like, get into trouble.
But he's also like not in his head about everything.
Yeah.
You know, like he, it feels like he's already let go of the survivor's guilt in some ways. He's just, you know, like he, again, representing another side of the Higabusha, like the side that, you know, is moving on without like the burdens.
Yeah.
Like he has the physical burden of being a survivor, not as much of the mental ones.
Yeah, the psychological one. Yeah. I forgot which character said it, but they told Moss, like, you're lucky that, you know, you don't have any damage on you. And, you know, we see in that scene with Moss and Mari that actually, like, there's a lot of damage to him psychologically. And I really like the, like, animosity between, like, Moss and Mari. Because, like, with Mari, I feel like she kind of embodies a lot of, like second-generation Asian-American experiences with, like, their immigrant parents of, like, why is your English so bad? Like, why can't you, like, you know, do things that are very simple? And then you also have Moss's wife, Chizuko, who is, like, you know, her English is much better. She's able to grasp the language better and able to do like tax forms and like very independent, right?
Yeah.
So I really like that because that is like a guilt that a lot of immigrant parents have.
And there was an NPR interview with Naomi Hirahara where she says basically Mari's grievances with her father were the same grievances that she had with her own father. Like when she grew up, she didn't understand why her father was always out working, wasn't good with English, and like
also like jealousy of like, okay, why, like, why are we so poor?
Yeah.
Yeah. Why can't you get a better job? And it's like, it's not that easy. And when you're a kid, you can't really understand.
Yeah.
Can't really understand that. And I liked getting Moss's perspective as well, because he's like, why are you going to Columbia? Like, you should stay in like California, UCLA, USC. Well,
to be fair, he was also a fan of UCLA basketball.
yeah, true. But like, I figured, like, I think a lot of immigrant parents, like, they do want their kid to, you know, never kind of leave their nest, because it's just because your immigrant parent is like relying on you so much for a lot of like logistical things.
And when Mari does go and like kind of becomes independent, like what leads to the estrangement is also the fact that she marries a because he's a white dude, right?
Yeah, he's a white dude
who is a gardener.
Yeah, and then it kind of ruins her parents' like expectations of her, like, having, I guess, like a white collar family and not having to go through the same things that they went through.
Yeah, which is I feel like it's, I don't know how common it is, but I hear a lot of narratives in the real life where you have, for example, children of restaurant families going to the restaurant business despite their parents like saying, we worked a restaurant so you didn't have to.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I think also with like going back to like immigrant parents not wanting their children to leave the nest.
Yeah.
I think it's also because you often don't have other family in America. So like your children are like your only ties to family in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
So like having your child go far away is like it's, you know, you're, It's hard. It's a lot of pain, and I really like that you see that from like a parent's perspective, because I feel like I tend to relate a lot more to the child, right? And we usually see that in books, but it's very, sometimes you don't really get the parent's perspective, and I really like that you see Joy, like,
yeah,
a contrast
just suppose
to
that
Mari.
With Tug and his wife Will, and their daughter who. It just goes to show it's like not all parents are the same, but parents are the same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It, like, I thought it was really funny how like Joy, like she was almost getting her PhD in physics and then she goes to medical school. And then now that she's like pretty much done with her residency, she's like, I don't think this is for me. I'm going to follow my true passion, which is painting. And like her parents being like, why are you doing this to us?
Why did we send you to PCC to take those classes?
I think that is like really, really funny because a lot of like Asian parents, like when you're younger, they like take you to all of these like art classes being like, you need to be able to paint. You need to be able to play an instrument. You have to play a sport. This is all for college so you can be an accountant or a doctor. And then they get mad that their child ends up like being like, oh, I want to actually do music. And it's like, how dare you? And it's like, well, they've been playing violin since they were five, so like actually it's your fault for for sending your kids to all of these programs.
I want to say I love the another story, another name for this book could also be The Corruption of Tug.
Oh yeah,
because he starts out as like this like straight-laced Christian veteran who's like very like he's literally your typical like boomer dad. Right.
Yeah, I mean, he was a freaking health inspector, which is like a government job. So, yeah.
And then slowly Moss like takes him to a gambling den, gets him beaten up. It was really amusing to see like this kind of straight-laced all-American dude get put in these situations.
Yeah.
And you find out that he has his own bocce because, you know, he took a bribe once and because of his like honest nature, he like turned himself in, and since then, he's been under his boss's thumb for like his whole entire career.
Yeah,
right now it's his bocce.
A small detail about Mari: she marries a white dude, but it turns out it was like a shotgun wedding, and Moss wasn't invited. He didn't even know that she was engaged, and like Lil Tug's wife, tells him all about it.
Well, Tug spills the beans.
Oh, I guess. Yeah.
And then Lil's like, I guess we should tell you now.
I guess we should tell you. Your daughter's pregnant.
Yeah.
And she's married.
And I guess that brings us to another through line of the book. It connected to bocce, I guess, is like the bocce of the atomic bomb. And it's just like the legacy of like the reason why like even descendants of people who experienced the bombing also refer to themselves as survivors is because we still don't know how it plays out.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, because the survivors of the bomb, like the first survivors, like health effects, a lot of miscarriages, a lot of like deformed babies and who didn't live.
Yeah. And not only that, but like Akemi's son, Yuki's father, Hikari, was perfectly healthy as a baby, but then he developed lung cancer despite never having smoked in his life. Right. And then Yuki himself says he goes in every year for a checkup, too, because he has abnormally high white blood cell count. And so I think that's also part of what is playing in Moss's mind when he finds out about his daughter's pregnancy is like, what did I pass on as well? Right.
Yeah. So you find out towards the end of the book that Nakane and like his boss, I guess, the reason why they want the land so badly, it's because there were some shady things going on. And it's like, at first I thought because Japan was they were having their boom and they were building all these like apartment complexes and shopping malls, I thought it was just like a strictly like transaction of like, okay, we're going to build something and we're going to make a lot of money off of it. But it turns out that there is some bad history to it. And I was actually really surprised that Naomi went there as someone who is Japanese American. So because like you find out that land was like a shanty town for a lot of Koreans.
Yeah.
Zainichi, which we learn in Pachinko. everything connects, you know. Yeah. You learn from each book and it helps you with future knowledge.
Yeah.
But you find out that there was like kind of like a giant ditch of some sorts that may have bodies of the Koreans who were imprisoned and the quote-unquote comfort women, the sex slaves who were forced to endure terrible things during the war. So you see that little bit of history. And I heard that Naomi actually revisits it in like a future book in the Masarai series. And I was actually surprised that like Comfort Woman was even mentioned, because it is something that Japan has denied for a number of years now.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if, because like 2004, like there was, I don't know if it was a prime minister, like Japan's prime minister at the time, or a different like high official in their government, but they did apologize for the damage that they did to the Koreans and also acknowledged Comfort Women. And then that was like, that apology was taken back after election of a different official.
Yeah.
And so I'm like wondering if that had happened around like the early 2000s and that was accounted for in the book.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I
yeah.
was surprised. It's not really something that, I mean, definitely the Japanese authors do not write that in their books. But Japanese Americans, they kind of have like a weird freedom. I don't think this book would have flown in Japan, you know, like with censorship and
probably
stuff like that.
I feel like that is, I mean, one of the hallmarks of Los Angeles-based detective fiction is it's all about like follow the money, follow the corruption. It's all about land rights and infrastructure and governments and the growth of like urban development. So in a way, it is kind of like a noir.
Yeah. I really do want to read the other books to see like how because the very last book in the series, Hiroshima Boy, came out last year, and Moss actually goes back to Japan for the first time in like over what 55 years, 60 years. I don't know how much time passes.
It's in the jacket description, but so you know, he goes back because Haruo passes away and that's his last dying wish. Poor one up Haruo, our good boy. I'm really interested in, and the book was such like, it was such a breezy read. Like,
yeah,
like it's one of those books where you can probably finish one every weekend if you wanted to.
Yeah. For the listeners out there who are not very good with reading flashbacks in between, like, I can see that grating some people. It depends on your preference. For me, like, it was fine.
Yeah.
Because I feel like with each flashback, you learn something new about a character. And it really helped with kind of, like, giving you clues as to where the mystery was going.
It was definitely well constructed.
It was very, very well constructed.
And as an Angeleno, like, it was really great to see the Los Angeles that I know be portrayed, because we record in Little Tokyo. We're in First Street North, which is the same block as the Chop Suey restaurant that they keep talking about, the Far East Cafe, which is now Far Bar.
Yeah, Far Bar. And also, like, the Empress Hotel. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's not called that anymore, but it still exists.
It's still upstairs.
It's still upstairs.
Yeah. I mean, this block in Little Tokyo, LA is probably the only block that still has the same buildings that it had back in, like, before the war.
Yeah, and the city of Los Angeles wanted to, burn it down to the ground. Like, they really wanted to, like, bulldoze over Little Tokyo so they can make more train stops or whatnot.
Yeah.
And, and I forgot how Little Tokyo combated that. I think it was...
They're still combating it right now.
Oh, okay. I thought it was kind of resolved with, like, the number of parking lots in this area, but...
It's an ongoing thing. People should check out the Little Tokyo Service Center and Sustainable Little Tokyo for more information on what's going on. Basically, they're still fighting the encroachment of, developers and gentrification in this neighborhood.
This is the only part of downtown LA that I actually like. like another thing, because it was like the last two books were set in New York. And I was like, oh, man, like as someone who like lived in New York, went to school in New York, I get it. And then I read this book and it's like set in the town that I am currently living in. And it's just like, oh, I get it. And
not only that, but it's also Asian American LA, because it's the San Gabriel Valley, it's Little Tokyo, and it's Sawtelle, which is
and Sawtelle, which is like in the opposite direction of LA, but somehow it works. And all the highways and the traffic, it was
ramen places in North Hollywood.
Yeah. So it really, like, it's nice when you know the setting.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really, really well done. So thank you, Naomi, for writing a really great book.
Yeah.
Great start to the series. I am very curious. I'm actually seeing Naomi like a couple of days from now, because since she lives near my neighborhood, like same bookstore, and she's really popular in Pasadena.
Oh yeah,
like super duper popular. And it's been nice because we've had like other Asian American authors at our local bookstore, Romans, and she's pretty much gone to every single one. Like, she supports a lot of up and coming Asian American authors, and she's super super nice. And
yeah,
it's really nice to see this, see older Asian American pioneers, I guess, in genres support other like up and coming authors.
And we should definitely talk with her sometime, because she's one of those authors who also didn't start writing until much later in their careers, right?
Yeah.
So it's it just goes to show, if you write what you know, there's going to be an audience for it. And And just something about having an old man who's just annoyed at everyone, but gets drawn into a mystery that only he can solve, is super fascinating.
I love cranky characters. I think it's because I'm also a cranky person who hates inconveniences. And it's like I don't know, it's really relatable. And I just love seeing older characters like taking the lead in stories.
Yeah. And with that, I guess that'll do it for our discussion of Summer of the Big Bocce by Naomi Hirahara, book one of the Mas Arai series of books. Definitely check it out. They're available in bookstores everywhere, online, on Kindle. I think both of us would recommend this book to anyone, right?
Yeah, probably. Especially if you live in the LA area. Like, I highly recommend it. I just noticed, I'm looking at the cover right now, there's a pair of cards at the very bottom, hint as to gambling.
Yeah. Rira, what are we reading for November 2019?
So our November 2019 book club pick is Steel Crow Saga by Paul Kruger. It is a very long book, so I suggest you, if you want to finish it by the end of November, early December, you should start now. That's advice to myself as I listen to this podcast, because I always monitor our episodes. But it has been described to me as Avatar: The Last Airbender meets Pokemon. And I'm really into both of those, like both fandoms. So yeah. I'm really excited to read this book. I've heard great things about it.
Yeah. Seasoned with Filipino folklore, right?
Yeah, seasoned with Filipino folklore. And this book is brand new, so I'm sorry for for those who are looking, who is looking for paperback or some cheaper options. We do want to mix things up in this podcast. We do want to read newer titles and older titles.
From all accounts, from people who have read the book, it's being received really, really well. So
yeah, really, really well.
Excited to crack it open and excited to crack it open and get started. But yeah.
Does this mean that you have to watch Avatar: The Last Airbender, Marvin?
Let's. You already said this book is going to be long. I can only focus on so many things at once. Let me read this book and then think about watching Avatar: The Last Airbender. Maybe I should just watch the movie to get the whole story.
No.
Right?
Wait for the live action at the very least, I guess.
So yeah, and with that, thank you for listening to Books and Boba's discussion of our October 2019 book club pick, Summer of the Big Bocce by Naomi Hirahara. I hope you all are having a great fall. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving season. And yeah.
We'll see you later this month.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We've got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation,
the good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallsbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.